Hello, this is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is December the 14th, 2021. And well, 2021 is drawing to an end, and there are some Americans abroad who have extensions, I guess, till December the 15th or whatever. But the bottom line is that the U.S. tax filing year, I guess, for 2020, even though it's 2021, is also drawing to an end, providing a relief and a bit of a vacation for Americans before they start again in a couple of weeks. Worrying about this, but my guest today is CPA Olivier Wagner, who I think is fairly well known in the community of Americans abroad because he runs, well, 1040 Abroad for Americans Abroad. And we're going to talk about various odds and ends of issues impacting Americans abroad, including, I guess, the renunciation and that sort of stuff. But welcome, Olivier. How are you today?
Thank you for having me. I'm doing well.
Well, I bet you're doing particularly well since the year is actually coming to an end. What is the deadline for those who got an extension to file the 2020 return right down to the last minute? Is it the 15th? Is it tomorrow?
Yes, exactly. December 15th. Right, regular deadline is June 15th. You can file an extension to October 15th, but since the two extensions are overlapping, you can send them a letter to get an additional 2 months, which brings us to December 15. There are a few special circumstances in which people might have an extension beyond that, but that's fairly rare. So yes, the furthest you can go without an explanation is December 15.
Wow. So, I mean, I know that you work hard and you're inundated with, you know, all these things to file for people. You must, you know, honestly feel a sigh of relief that after December 15th until tax season starts again.
Well, yes, I'm getting ready for the next tax season, but yes.
I mean, what will you do with your life? I mean, with this gap in the world, just as though the world stops.
Yeah, there's nothing to do. If there's no tax, there's nothing to do. Yeah.
Oh my God. But I'm sure you'll find something. Well, let's make this sort of a recap of the year in review. I mean, 2021 has been, you know, a really, really tough year because it's the first full year of, you know, all the COVID related issues and, you know, lockdown.
It's not in 2020. Yeah, I mean, we filed in 2021 the returns for 2020, but for people who wanted to schedule an appointment to renounce U.S. citizenship, they had been facing the backlog since 2020.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is absolutely incredible. I mean, that the way I experienced that was around the third week of March 2020. It just sort of came to a standstill worldwide. Is that your impression of it as well?
Yes, I think most U.S. consulates were closed for anything other than emergencies from March 2020 to August 2020. So I think they were still issuing emergency passports, and that's pretty much the only service they did.
Well, you know, there's certainly a huge, huge backlog of people waiting to renounce. At least in Canada, it's moving again, and they do seem to be, you know, trying to aggressively clear the background. I'm experiencing people are, you know, getting appointments where they have to show up in 3 or 5 days or something.
Yes. I mean, we already had a backlog of over 6 months prior to disclosure. And now they're cleaning up all of these appointments that were scheduled between March and August 2020 to get those out of the way, so to clear the way for people who would like a new appointment.
Yeah, you know, we got this problem. I mean, I don't know if you're seeing this, but we've got this huge problem that, you know, the run-up in real estate prices since the COVID thing began and the inability to get appointments. I mean, I'm finding that there are actually a reasonable number of people who are now covered expatriates based on the net worth who would not have been, you know, if they'd been able to have gone through with their renunciations in the normal course. Do you find that as well?
Yeah, there might be some of that. I have people who want to sell their real estate and wait until after they were announced, because you know, the sale of a primary residence is not taxed in Canada.
And yeah, you know what? Could you pause and just, you know, blow that out a little bit? Because I mean, that's a really significant problem, right? At least in Canada, there's certainly, you know, people who, you know, want to get the principal residence exemption and have got to not be a U.S. citizen to do it, right?
Right, exactly. Yes. And so they've been delaying the sale of their condo or house until such time that they can get that appointment at the U.S. consulate, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now let's imagine that I was talking to somebody yesterday, for example, who has actually gotten, this is somebody I started working with literally 3 years ago. Okay.
Right. Yes.
Who, this is incredible. Who finally has an appointment the first half of January.
Right.
And now let's imagine a situation where somebody is waiting to renounce before they sell their house. Why don't we talk about what's the effective date of loss of U.S. citizenship for tax purposes?
Right.
So you can go or I can go, or what are your thoughts?
But we should give a little bit of background in that there's two ways to give up U.S. citizenship, one being relinquishment, the other one being renunciation. I mean, technically, renunciation is a form of relinquishment, but... But renunciations take place at the time of that appointment at the consulate, and it would result in a certificate of loss of nationality dated as of the date of that appointment.
Okay, let's just pause for 1 second and make sure that that is clear. So we're talking about a straight renunciation.
Right.
I renounce my U.S. citizenship in present day time. And let's imagine that takes place on January 15th, assuming that's a normal day of the week.
Right.
Now, I am understanding you to be saying that the loss of citizenship for tax purposes would take place on the same day as the renunciation, after the renunciation. Is that what you're saying?
Right, for both tax purposes and immigration purposes.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, we've got two kinds of citizenship, basically. You know, we have citizenship for nationality and we have citizenship for tax. Okay. All right. So as I understand it, though, although we know that that's the case, it's not official until the certificate of loss of nationality has been issued, right?
Right. So the renunciation would be effective as of the date of that appointment at the consulate, provided, of course, that it's ultimately approved by the Department of State. And in the case of an adult without mental illness, there's a 99% chance that this renunciation will be approved. In the case of a child between the age of 16 and 18, the likelihood of approval is less than that.
Less, but I would say probably still likely. But okay, so your point is, and I think this is correct, that so let's imagine our January 15th, 2022 appointment. Somebody goes in and renounces.
Right.
They cease to be a U.S. citizen for both tax and nationality purposes on the day of renunciation.
Right.
But it's not official until they get the certificate of loss of nationality. But the loss of nationality is just a confirmation that they lost citizenship on the 15th of January. Okay.
Yes, the point of that appointment is to convince the consulate that such person indeed understands the implication of giving up U.S. citizenship, that it's an irrevocable decision, and they act voluntarily, which is the issue with people under the age of 18, because there's the presumption that a parent or some other adult might have influenced them. So that's the purpose of the appointment, and the consulate will take some notes, will send it to Washington, D.C., where the Department of State will approve of that renunciation and send the certificate of loss of nationality.
Okay. Now, Under the current laws, meaning the laws that took effect on June 16th, 2008, are you required to file anything under the Internal Revenue Code? My understanding is you don't. Okay. Do you have to file anything under the Internal Revenue Code in order to cease to be a U.S. citizen for tax purposes, assuming that you renounce after June 16th, 2008? Or is the certificate of loss of nationality enough to sever tax residency on a going forward basis?
I mean, technically you don't. I mean, you want to prove that you're not a covered expatriate and you would file from 8854 with your final tax return.
But going forward, yeah, we'll get to that in a second, but just so it's clear to people. January 16th, the person could sell their house and not be subject to a U.S. capital gains tax?
Yes, actually, they can do that on January 15, even. They would be taxed up to the day before that appointment.
Okay, all right. But to be super safe, say the day after, whatever. Okay.
Yes.
All right, so you know, I think that's important to know. So in terms of severing tax residency, meaning you're no longer subject to U.S. tax, it is effective with a valid renunciation, correct?
Right.
Do we agree on that? Okay. All right. Now, you know, I didn't mean to cut you off there. I just wanted to, you know, to really reinforce that first point. But yet, everybody does, you know, file taxes. They file this form 8854. And what does that do for them? I mean, you know, so you renounce, you're no longer a U.S. tax citizen going forward. I mean, so they tell you to file an 8854. What does that do for you by doing that?
Right, there's various questions that can assist the IRS to determine whether you're a covered expatriate or not. There are various implications to being a covered expatriate, the main one being that you're subject to the exit tax. There's a deemed disposition of all of your assets as of the day before you renounced.
Okay, and that's of course possibly a very bad thing. But to be clear here, so you're saying that if you don't file the 8854, then you would be a covered expatriate. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's right, because there are three tests, right? There's three ways that one can be a covered expatriate, and
right,
you can list them, or I can list them. Why don't you list them?
Well, you need to be compliant for the past 5 years to avoid covered expatriate status, be tax compliant over the past 5 years, have an average tax liability of less than $160,000 over the prior 5 years.
That's U.S. tax liability.
Right, U.S. tax liability. It's the income tax after credits. So if you use the foreign tax credits and the amount of income tax owing after the foreign tax credit is less than that, that's the amount you would look at. That's not the amount before credits. It's also not the other taxes, self-employment tax, net investment income tax. It doesn't refer to this tax. And what I found is that I almost never have people who meet that test. And my understanding would be that if someone was to meet that test, they would also meet the third test, which is having more than $2 million of net worth, because to owe that much tax and have less than $2 million of net worth, you must be very diligent in spending it, right?
That's interesting, because as I listen to you talk about that, every time I hear somebody talk about this, I can almost tell what part of the world their client base is from.
Right.
What you're talking about is somebody who probably is in a high tax country.
Exactly.
But let's say you're on the Gulf, where there is not an income tax. I mean, I have over the years worked with people in the Gulf who very high U.S. tax liability, almost no net worth. Interesting.
Okay.
So, but it does seem to me, and I'd love your comment on this, that I thought was really interesting and important, the way you were saying that you're starting to say, well, anybody who's paying that much tax probably has a high net worth. You know, and that's what I would have thought too. But you know what's interesting is that that 160 or what I think it's 100, it's indexed to inflation, whatever it is, 160, 170.
Right.
That is indicative of a very high income for sure. But this 2 million net worth threshold is not much at all, is it?
Right. I mean, if you own real estate in a lot of cities in the world, in the Western world, you can easily reach that the $2 million of assets. It's a net wealth, so it's net of your liabilities. And there's also people who can have some planning opportunities by gifting some of their assets, typically to a spouse.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So you mean by planning opportunities, a way to reduce your net worth, so you're below the 2 million.
Right.
Okay. Sure. An example or two of that. How would somebody do that?
But they would gift assets to their spouse. They can change the title on their house from being joined to being owned by their spouse only. They can, you know, gift cash or securities.
So basically it's the principle of gifting your way
right
to a lower net worth. Okay. So, you know, that's interesting, because would you agree that gifting, you need to be a little careful, because if you're making gifts, you know, obviously outside the U.S., you need to pay attention to the laws that might apply in your country of residence, right?
Right, obviously.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, I don't know what the answer is particularly. I mean, it varies from country to country, but, you know, that's an interesting problem for sure. Can somebody just make a gift to a spouse without any tax, from a U.S. point of view, without any tax consequences?
They can gift about $11 million during their lifetime before paying a gift tax. But in the case of a spouse, if the amount is more than $145,000, they would file a gift tax return. And what that would do is deduct the amount of the gift from the 11 million they can give during their lifetime. Obviously, the 11 million mark can change over time as new laws get passed and new administrations get in charge of politics in the US. So that would be deducted from that 11 million, but of course the lifetime exemption might change during their lifetime.
Yeah, you know, let's stay on that for one second, because this is an area where I've noticed that there's a great deal of confusion. So under the current lifetime limitation, any U.S. citizen can give up to $11 million lifetime to anybody they want without paying a gift tax, right?
Right.
Okay. And that would include a non-citizen spouse.
Right.
What if, though, if you were to make an $11 million gift, for example, to a U.S. citizen spouse, you're not, that has nothing to do with it, right? You're able to do that, aren't you, without eating into it?
Right, exactly. There's no limit between two U.S. citizen spouses, whereas there is this limit from a U.S. citizen to a non-resident spouse.
Non-citizen spouse. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, when you're having a conversation, I guess, with somebody, with, you know, a married couple about that, I guess you better be pretty clear on what the citizenship of the recipient spouse is, right?
Right.
Okay. So that's interesting. I mean, do you find that to be fairly common, or a lot of people sort of gifting away assets to get below that 2 million?
That's the typical way under which they get under the $2 million threshold, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Am I right in saying that under the current exemptions that a U.S. citizen can give, I think, $159,000 annually to a non-citizen spouse without it being subject to the gift tax regime at all?
Right, that's correct.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, isn't it? That's interesting as well.
That amount would be $15,000 if that was not a spouse, and $159,000 to a non-resident, non-citizen spouse.
So So in other words, if you're a U.S. citizen and wanted to stay out of the whole gift tax issue altogether, you can make any, my understanding is you can make any number of gifts to any number of individuals, up to 15,000 per individual. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
Up to 159,000 if it is a non-citizen spouse. Can you have more than one spouse?
No, not only the first one counts.
Okay. All right. No, there are places in the world, you know, where people have more than one spouse. Okay. All right. You know, that's kind of interesting because it, you know, from a cultural point of view, right, it sort of imposes U.S. or Western cultural values on the rest of the world, actually. Okay. All right. So basically, you know, gifting is certainly an option. Do you have any thoughts on where that, you know, if you're tax compliant, that there are certain circumstances you don't even have to worry about the net worth issue, the dual citizenship exemption from birth, for example?
Right. So these would
be... What are your thoughts on that?
Right, these would be people who are born with dual citizenship, U.S. citizenship and the citizenship of a foreign country, and who are still tax residents of that foreign country. Those people need to be compliant with their prior 5 years of tax returns to avoid covered expatriate status. But the two other tests don't apply to them.
Wow, that's amazing. So in other words, if you're lucky enough to be born as a dual citizen, you know, you can avoid that exit tax just by, you know, being compliant on your tax returns. That's quite the deal, isn't it? At least relative to the poor schmuck who's only born with one citizenship.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can see the value of second citizenships more and more, right? Now that's very interesting. But to emphasize, you know, the way you state that correctly is that the person still has to be a tax resident of the country of dual citizenship. And I found that does trip a lot of people up, actually. You know, they were born dual citizens, but, you know, they aren't tax resident of.
White people move. Yeah.
Okay. You know, you started a minute or so ago to mention relinquishments, okay, as opposed to a renunciation. Maybe we ought to talk about that a little bit and, you know, what, if anything, might be different there. You know, So maybe again with what is the difference anyway between renunciation and relinquishment?
Relinquishment takes place when somebody performs an expatriating act, typically acquiring a foreign citizenship. With the intent of giving up their U.S. citizenship. So that's the key part. A few decades ago, the U.S. government was actively taking the stance that if someone was acquiring a foreign citizenship, they clearly did so with the intent of giving up U.S. citizenship. Now they take the opposite approach in that the onus is on the taxpayer to convince them that they indeed had this intent, and that means they should stop behaving like a U.S. citizen from that point on, be it by voting in U.S. elections, filing tax returns, or doing other things that are only available to U.S. citizens.
All right, well, you know, that is quite a mouthful, so let's unpack that just a little bit. So the renunciation is where you do an unpatriotic thing, namely renounce in the presence in the U.S. consulate.
Right.
And the relinquishment is where you do an unpatriotic thing outside the consulate, right? Would that be the basic? Okay. And so let's use that example. So then we have a legal test for the doing the bad thing outside the consulate, that whatever that bad thing is, it has to be done obviously voluntarily and with the clear intention of relinquishing U.S. citizenship. So, you know, we're both in Canada. And so we know, I think we both have had plenty of experience with people who, you know, met that test or arguably met that test. So you become you naturalize as a Canadian. If you're not listening from Canada, substitute your country. And you do it, you know, with the intention, although you don't have to tell that to the government of Canada, of relinquishing U.S. citizenship. And you're saying that would qualify. You know, there's plenty of evidence that it does.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And so then you're making your appointment, not to go in and renounce, but rather to confess, if you will, that you've done this unpatriotic thing of committing an expatriating act, becoming a citizen of another country voluntarily with the intention of relinquishing U.S. citizenship.
Right. You want the consulate to confirm that you indeed relinquished and issue a certificate of loss of nationality confirming that relinquishment happened.
Okay. All right. So if I'm understanding it correctly, then either doing the bad thing in the consulate, the renunciation, or outside the consulate, relinquishment, all these things lead to a certificate of loss of nationality, right?
That's correct. In the case of a relinquishment, it would be backdated to the date of that expatriating act, whereas in the case of a renunciation, it would be dated as of the date of that appointment.
Okay, now let's pause and drive that point home, because I think one has to visualize what a CLN looks like, a certificate of loss of nationality. So the date, okay, and I emphasize for nationality purposes, if you renounce, would be the date that you renounced. But for immigration purposes, it would be the date that you committed the relinquishing act, right? Which would necessarily be earlier, correct?
Right, exactly.
Now that's interesting. Huh. Does that have any implication for when you cease to be a U.S. tax citizen, or does it depend on the date when you did that?
Right. You would still report your worldwide income up till that the day of the appointment at the consulate and file a dual status return for the year in which that appointment took place.
Okay. So
worldwide income before and only your U.S. source income after.
Okay. So what you're saying here is under the existing law, and this is written into the law, since I guess to June 3rd, 2004, since June 3rd, 2004, although a relinquishment would get you a loss of citizenship for nationality purposes and a backdated thing, it would not get you the relinquishment for tax purposes. I'm understanding. Okay, I think, right. In other words, it's an amazing situation if you think about it, right? Because, let's just imagine, February 1st, 2010, somebody relinquishes U.S. citizenship by becoming a Canadian.
Right.
And this assumes that they behave in that way. They don't then go out and try to get a U.S. passport or something, right?
Right.
But aren't they then in the situation where they have no immigration status in the United States at all, but they're still subject to U.S. worldwide taxation? Have I got that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Isn't that something? Think of it. No right to enter the U.S., no status, but still subject to worldwide taxation.
Right.
Wow. this is a problem, I think, for green card holders as well. So, yeah, but, and here's something we've talked about in the past and certainly seen quite a bit of. What if the relinquishing act is, so June 3rd, 2004, my memory serves as the date that the U.S. Congress created the tax citizen, the concept of tax citizen. So what if you're relinquishing prior to June 3rd, 2004? Does that put you in a better position?
Yes, then you would... You would not be subject to tax from that point on, from the time you actually relinquished.
So your position would be that if the relinquishing act is prior to June 3rd, 2004, then your loss of citizenship for tax purposes would be that day simply because they had not yet created the tax citizen.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Now that's an interesting way to look at it. I think that that's certainly a very reasonable, rational approach, although it's interesting that there are people who do not agree with that. They interpret, these laws retroactively. Let me just ask you this question. It's one thing to theorize about this, but have you ever seen a situation where, somebody got a CLN based on a relinquishing act, way back then, back in the day in the 70s, the 80s or something, who,
right,
has ever been pressured to file taxes by the U.S. government?
No, I have not encountered that.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that the way you describe it is probably the most reasonable practice. But, you know, as always, we're dealing with this hugely complex area. And the thing that characterizes almost every aspect of this is that it's, you know, very difficult to understand. So we take two broad extremes, right? We look at the relinquishment. So you're saying that a relinquishment, becoming a Canadian, say, February 1st, 2010, you're a U.S. You're in the U.S. tax system until the date that you go to the consulate. I'm understanding you correctly?
Yes, absolutely.
And if you became a Canadian on February 1st, 1994, and you get a backdated relinquishment to that effect, then you're presumptively not in the U.S. tax system. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. All right. But under the current law, since June 16, 2008, there's no requirement to do anything other than get the CLN to end tax obligations going forward, correct?
Yes.
And the final part of the quiz, what about from June 3rd, 2004 to June 16th, 2008? And it's perfectly okay to say, I don't know, because nobody knows.
I think it's
maybe the worst answer is the answer. I don't know.
Wait.
But that's kind of an interesting problem, isn't it, right? Because interestingly, from June 3rd, 2004 to June 16th, 2008, you did have to file an 8854.
Right.
December tax residence, as you know. So, yes. So, my God, you would think all of this would be so simple, wouldn't you?
Well, I don't know. It's a complex topic. Anyway,
it's an incredibly complex topic. Incredibly complex. I mean, you know, one thing that is super clear though is this: that if your taxes are not in order, okay, that is the one thing
that will make you a covered expatriate.
Yeah. That can, you know, well, the failure to file the 8854, but that's the one thing that you need to save yourself, you know, from a lot of potential problems anyway, which means that, you know, if somebody wants to get their U.S. taxes in order, probably the best practice would be call Olivier.
Yes, contact me. Go to 1040award.com. There's a contact form right there on the homepage, and we'll get back to you within 24 hours.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll do a plug here for my friend Olivier, who I've known for many years and, you know, seems to me to know what he's doing and help people navigate through the horrible quagmire of U.S. taxation abroad. So, you know, as we sort of come to a close here, are there any other messages or topics that you think would be worth adding into this podcast?
Well, it's simply that the backlog that we described exists in countries where there's a large American expat population, Canada, Western Europe, Australia. People who are in a rush to renounce can contact consulates, U.S. consulates outside these areas. A U.S. consulate outside of your country of residence does not have the obligation to accommodate you for an appointment, but they can do so at their own discretion. And in a less developed country where there are fewer Americans who live there, the U.S. consulate might have the space to accommodate you for a renunciation.
Practically speaking, what are you finding talking to people? Are they successful in getting appointments outside their country of residence or not?
It's still not the norm, but yeah, I had someone in Burma who she just walked into the consulate and they and she announced right there and then. But she was based in Burma at the time she had the work permit. You cannot travel to Burma because of the COVID-19 Burmese immigration laws. So that doesn't really help most people. I had somebody else who was based in Germany who went to Azerbaijan and he got an appointment within 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've had, you know, odds and ends for people unable to get appointments, but the combination of the pre-existing, you know, we generally reserve these appointments for residents of the country coupled with the COVID travel things has really made it very difficult. you know, like Australia's been doing appointments for, you know, really the last year or so, but you can't get into Australia.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, it's interesting to me that Canada at the moment actually seems to be, you know, the most sort of fluid. I mean, as far as I can see, they're, you know, they're working pretty aggressively to clear up the backlog, you know, which is very, very good news.
Yeah.
All right. So are you going to survive for like 3 weeks without doing U.S. tax returns?
Yes, I'll just get some wine and, you know, next to the fireplace and just try to forget about U.S. tax.
Okay. You know, I just want to make sure that you don't lose your edge, okay? Because, you know, good U.S. tax preparers are few and far between, and it would be a great loss to the community of Americans abroad if you get so comfortable in the next few weeks that you decide to not come back. So are you going to commit to being back in 2022?
Yeah, I'll be back. Like I said, people can keep on contacting me using the contact form on the website, and I'll get back to them in 24 hours.
All right. Even while you're your 3 week wine binge in front of the fireplace, you'll do that.
Yes.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. Well, this has been great to catch up with you today. And, you know, I wish you a happy 3 weeks. And, you know, don't forget the little people who still have to work during these 3 weeks, Olivier.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
All right. Great speaking with you. And yeah. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.